This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for downloading The Briefing Room from the BBC, the new Radio 4 programme that aims to give you what you need to know about the big stories in the news. This week, as the security services declare that Northern Ireland-related terrorism now represents a substantial threat to Great Britain, David Aronovich asks, who are the new IRA?
They were just ordinary people. They weren't wearing masks or anything like that. It was just individuals I'd never seen before. The car pulled up and says, are you Henry? And I said, yes. And they said, well, have you left your mobile phones and any electronic equipment at your hotel as instructed? I said, yes. I was driven across the Irish border into a very isolated place. Within the hour, another car pulled up, another individual came out. He handed me a statement, and after I wrote the statement down in my notebook, he burned a copy of his own statement and drove off. It was a most bizarre experience, a very strange encounter, but that was how I first got the first communique from the new IRA.
Good evening. That was the journalist Henry MacDonald telling the story of how, 4 years ago, he was called in to witness the birth of the new IRA. Earlier this month, as a result of this group's activities, the threat level to Britain from Irish terrorism was raised from moderate to substantial. So who are the new IRA? Follow me into the briefing room and we'll find out. Sitting here with me is Peter Taylor, who's been covering Northern Ireland and terrorism for the BBC for many years. Feeding in from Belfast is Suzanne Breen, who writes for the Belfast Telegraph. And from Dublin, Henry MacDonald of The Guardian and The Observer. Peter Taylor, Dark Fields and Mysterious Calls, that must have had some resonance for you.
It does bring back a few memories, although the people I tended to meet were wearing masks in those days.
Now, let's go briefly through where, if you like, they kind of fit into the family tree of Irish republicanism. How have these people come about? Where are they from?
There have always been splits in the IRA ever since the beginning of the 20th century. Where the new IRA comes from, the origins of it, the stem, if you like, starts just before the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, when the IRA made the decision historically to enter the power-sharing arrangement at Stormont. This was the cardinal sin of republicanism because effectively the IRA were accepting partition, although of course they denied it, but in effect that's what they were doing. As a result of that, senior members of the provisional IRA, that we know as the IRA, walked out of the meeting led by the IRA's quartermaster general, who knew where the weapons were, knew where the dumps were. He and that group who walked out still form the basis of the new IRA, which is a combination of other dissident groups. But the driving force behind the new IRA are these people who split with the IRA over the issue of joining a Stormont government way back in the year before the Good Friday Agreement.
Now, as far as I can gather, one of the things that kind of kept them going or that kept their hand in was the fact of what was going on in some of these Republican nationalist areas with the vigilante organisations which had been set up by Republicans to police their areas. What was the relationship there?
It's very interesting, and it's a surprising relationship because the new IRA is made up of the dissidents who left before the Good Friday Agreement and other dissident groups. But one of them, the one you refer to, known as the Republican Action Against Drugs, which is based in the Cregan area in Derry, Londonderry, the Cregan area of Derry, Londonderry, and it is forcing drug dealers to get out of town on pain of death or blowing their kneecaps away. And the members of this group, this grouping, wish to present themselves as the true defenders of the community, and in the process they try to undermine the efforts of the police service of Northern Ireland to get the community support. They're very vicious, very nasty, and have been reasonably successful. The fact that they have now amalgamated as part of the new IRA, I think, is very significant.
Suzanne, we'll be coming to the question of who in the wider community supports the new IRA a bit later. But at the moment, what do we know of the people? We've heard from Peter, you know, some of these old grizzled figures who have been part of it. But what do we know about the people who are joining now, the members of it?
I suppose that they would be representative of the general working class nationalist Catholic community in Northern Ireland. The people who join up are overwhelmingly male. There would be a wide variety of ages, from their late teens to people that are involved that are in their 60s. We know this from looking at convicted prisoners, both in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland, when we look at the prison lists and we see who's convicted by the courts. But there have been some women members. The new IRA would be strongest and recruiting most from urban areas of Northern Ireland, from Belfast, from Derry, from a town called Lurgan in the middle of the state. I think perhaps there would maybe be less diversity than there was in the provisional IRA. Now, that is because the provisional IRA were recruiting in far greater numbers. So you will have maybe more middle class people, more people from surprising organisations. Though we have had graduates who have joined dissident Republican groups. Most of the people in leadership positions would be ex-provisional IRA activists. They would be people in their late 40s and their 50s. But there are, is young people, mainly in deprived areas, who are joining up.
You said in fewer numbers than the provisional IRA. So what kind of numbers are we talking about, do you think?
I think we would be talking maybe about 100 people, but we would be talking with a larger support base then of activists willing to help out.
Henry, what a lot of listeners will be asking is, why would any young person who wasn't around for the Troubles be at all interested in any of this stuff?
The sort of young people that are signing up to these organisations or their satellites, their political agitation groups, are generally speaking from the poorest wards of Northern Ireland, the poorest wards indeed of the UK. They have very little going for them in life, lack of job, lack of social prospects. So being in these organisations gives them a meaning to their existence. Coupled with that, there's the whole folk memory, you know, being passed down from parents and older siblings and grandparents and so on about the days of the armed struggle, which they did not live through. They didn't live through the horror of the Troubles. So it's all a romanticised and myth-making. And they're surrounded on the walls of where they grew up, whether it's in Derry or West Belfast, with the iconography, the murals, romanticising, you know, armed actions and hunger strikes and men with masks and guns. So it you can see the attraction if you've little investment in life or society. And it's no accident that the most deprived parts of the UK, places like Craigan and Derry, are the places that are the pool from which the new IRA can draw recruits.
Peter, from what you can tell, what is it that they actually want?
What they want is actually very simple. They want a united Ireland. They believe that the only way to achieve the goal, the final goal of republicanism, is by using physical force, by an armed campaign. In a word, what they want is what the IRA, the original IRA, the provisional IRA, the IRA of Martin McGuinness wanted way back in 1972 when they met the British Secretary of State, Willie Whitelaw, at Cheyne Walk, and said to Mr. Whitelaw, when he said, "What do you want?" The IRA said, "We want you out, the Brits out, in 3 years' time by 1975. It was simple as that. They're irredentist, they are absolutist, they make no brook, they're not in the business of any accommodation. They want the Brits out.
Now, I'm bound to point out to all three of you that they are looking on after the, if you like, the peak of post-war Irish republicanism. The activities of the Provisional IRA has passed, has gone. We're now nearly 20 years on from the Good Friday Agreement. What on earth is their strategy to achieve, for them, this small organisation, to achieve what the Provisional IRA never achieved?
David, I think that their strategy,
Henry,
one of their strategies is the politics of anti-normality. What I mean by that is they don't want Northern Ireland to be a normal society. They want to say it's something abnormal. So, for example, that is why one of their prime targets is a Catholic policeman. It's somebody from the nationalist Catholic community who joins the police service of Northern Ireland. And indeed, in 2010, they murdered a police officer, Constable Ronan Kerr, in Omagh, the site, of course, of the biggest atrocity of the Troubles carried out by the real IRA in 1998. So there's this kind of politics of creating abnormality, of not allowing the state to become normal and like any other ordinary society. And this is kind of part of the strategy, although ultimately I don't think it's going to work. But that's what they're getting at. They're trying to destabilise the power-sharing settlement in Northern Ireland with all its outcomes, including policing.
What they would actually like, though, I don't think they are going to be able to achieve it, would be to see British soldiers back in the streets, that the security situation became so bad in Northern Ireland that the PSNI, our police force, couldn't cope and was basically way, way out of its depth, and soldiers were back in the streets. And that would very much show the physical force of that British rule is continuing in Northern Ireland. What they don't like is that while British rule politically is there, there is no physical sign of it on the streets. And they would like to be able to point to soldiers in the streets, and they could say to the nationalist Catholic community, we are still an occupied country.
So that's where they want to get to. So let's look at their capability of actually provoking those situations. Let's see what they're actually able to do. Peter, you've been looking into this for us.
Yes, I did an interview with Assistant Chief Constable Will Kerr of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. That's the RUC's successor. And Mr. Kerr is head of the PSNI's counter-terrorism department. He works very, very closely with MI5 in Northern Ireland. The link between the PSNI and MI5 is now almost umbilical. So he's in a good position to give an assessment. Obviously, there is huge concern, not just in Northern Ireland, but about the possibility of attacks here on the so-called mainland Britain. And there are good reasons for the concern. In recent weeks, there has been the murder of a prison officer who died as a result of a bomb under his car. There's been the murder of a taxi driver. And there's been very recently the uncovering of a considerable arms cache near Lurgan, in which was found a homemade armour-piercing warhead, rounds of high-velocity bullets and various components for making bombs. And this is what ACC Will Kerr said to me.
The new IRA are a dangerous grouping who have a wide range of attack capabilities and the intent to continue to kill and to stop political progress in Northern Ireland. The leadership would be comprised of former provisional members who have very significant terrorist experience.
Semtex has been used in several explosive devices placed beneath cars and other explosive devices. Where does the Semtex come from?
Well, that type of Semtex, some of it simply isn't manufactured anymore, so people will draw their own conclusions from that.
Old IRA dumps. So not all the IRA's weaponry, guns and explosives, was decommissioned.
Well, that would be our assessment.
Some former senior members of the provisional IRA are behind the formation of the new IRA. Other former senior members of the provisional IRA are now in power in Stormont. Are those former IRA members and their supporters giving you information that will help you combat the dissidents?
Well, perhaps if I could answer that in another way. I don't think we've yet got to the point where communities on both sides of the divide, loyalist and in particular Republican, are comfortable giving information to what is perceived as a state.
They don't want to be seen as touts.
Yeah. One, we don't have a shared narrative around how events were perceived to have been policed in the past. But secondly, there is a significant community muscle memory that has its own toxic narrative around touting the threat that posed and people have been killed on that basis in the past.
Have you received intelligence from your agents or via electronic surveillance that they are actively planning to target Great Britain?
Well, dissident Republican groupings have always had that intent.
But in recent terms?
Well, we simply won't comment on specific intelligence.
Presumably you have, because that's one of the reasons why the threat level has been raised.
And you may presume, but we simply won't comment on that publicly. The whole purpose of raising the threat level is an assessment in the round based on the other capabilities. They've always had the intent, of course, and our job is to try and stop them. But our job is also to raise public awareness.
Is the threat real?
An attack is a strong possibility. If it wasn't, MI5 simply wouldn't have said that publicly, and we fully support and endorse MI5's assessment.
Are you worried?
Well, our job's to be worried. I'm paid to be worried, but I'm also paid to manage that threat. We have been very successful in stopping the vast majority of attacks, but there is no perfect security solution to a threat that exists from within our own communities.
That was the softly spoken and discreet Will Kerr, Assistant Chief Constable for the Police Service of Northern Ireland. So we have serious veterans, terrorists in there. We have some access to weapons and weapons caches, some of them improvised, some of them acquired. We'll come into that in a moment. What the PSNI was clearly not going to talk about was their intelligence. But, Henry, presumably the police and the intelligence services are all over this.
Oh, yes, they are. There's evidence of that all the time. For example, there was a big arms cache found recently in the last 7 days, a huge amount of weaponry. I think Peter referred to it. That was something that was under surveillance, that was found out via electronic surveillance and human intelligence. I would argue, look, at maybe the majority of attacks are thwarted, 3 out of every 4 that the new IRA and other groupings are trying to carry out. And also it should be said and should be absolutely stressed that a lot of the intelligence is also flowing from the Irish Republic. The Garda Síochána have clear inroads in these organisations. Partly that's because a lot of this organisation has some intersect with the Dublin criminal fraternity, which can be easier to be infiltrated. And I think the Garda Síochána needs to be commended as well in terms of that's the intelligence they're passing up from south to north.
For those of us whose Irish is not very good, the Garda Síochána is essentially the police force in the Irish Republic. Suzanne, how does an organisation like this sustain its activities? I mean, it's not exactly cheap, even to do low-level terrorism. Where's the money coming from?
Funds is a major problem for the new IRA and the other dissident Republican groups. The Provisional IRA became a very, very wealthy organisation. First of all, it had backing from some influential figures in Irish America. There was a lot of funds came from sympathisers there. But in its later years, the Provisional IRA basically became a huge corporate entity. It went into legitimate businesses, and it was a multi-million pounds corporation with a big, big turnover. The dissident Republican organisations, they don't have that. They mainly rely on smuggling along the border, on diesel laundering, on counterfeit cigarettes and alcohol. But they have a big bill to foot in terms of paying for the families of their prisoners. There's a lot of people in jail, and they also need money to buy weapons, and I think they are very much cash starved.
Well, they find it difficult to get high velocity weapons such as the IRA had in great quantities, courtesy Colonel Gaddafi in the 1980s. The best supply of high-velocity weapons is Eastern Europe. They have made several attempts to get weapons in Eastern Europe. They have been foiled by the activities, really good intelligence by MI5 and MI6. So increasingly, they are turning to the drug gangs, the crime gangs, the criminal gangs in Dublin, who've got plenty of weaponry, and it's believed that several of their weapons are coming from that particular source.
Have they any new bombing expertise?
Well, their bombing expertise is based on the availability of Semtex, which is the booster for the kind of bombs that they use. But they've also learnt lessons from seeing the way in which IEDs, that's improvised explosive devices, have been used in Iraq and Afghanistan. And putting them together is not really that difficult. My own feeling is about What they lack, and Suzanne and Henry referred to this, is an issue. Because if you're going to generate support, and these campaigns need support, they need safe houses, they need people to hide weapons, to carry weapons, they need support which is garnered via an issue. The IRA, the crucial issue that was the Semtex for the political IRA, Sinn Féin in the 1980s, was the hunger strike. that generated huge support that drove the IRA and Sinn Féin through the 1980s to where we are today. The dissidents, the new IRA, do not have that issue. And as Henry said, one of the reasons that they want the Brits back on the street is so they can sort of perpetrate the myth that they are under the British jackboot again. So they desperately need an issue, and there's no sign whatsoever they're going to have one or have one. And the prisons are not an issue for the dissidents as it was for the IRA.
Suzanne, Peter's taken us into the issue of gaining support, but let's look at the support that is currently there. I'm presuming that there is a level of toleration or support within some of the nationalist communities that allows these people to keep going. Is that support active? Is it passive? How much of it is there?
To say that they have no support is wrong. There are people who provide safe houses, who hide members after attacks, who look after weapons, store weapons. So they do have support. There was a massive demonstration in Cole Island in County Tyrone, of a very strong nationalist heartland at Easter, which would commemorate the 1916 Rising, the big event in the Republican calendar when Irish rebels in Dublin rose up against the British. And there was 2,000 or 3,000 people at that. So that does show a level of support. But there doesn't seem to be a real growing level of support in the nationalist community. It seems to be the same number of people at different rallies. And I think if, for example, they did have a hunger strike in the prisons here, it just wouldn't strike a chord with people. We wouldn't see the same as we did in 1981 and a huge outpouring on the streets.
Of course, we got very used to the idea that alongside the provisional IRA was the provisional Sinn Féin, organising all this kind of stuff in the community. Is there an equivalent of that?
Let me say this. I think that because we've had the Good Friday Agreement, we've had the institutions of power sharing for so long, the Catholic community now has, in a majority sense, political investment in the state of Northern Ireland. And even if you look at opinion polls, there's a large section of the Catholic population would even vote to stay within the Union if there was a referendum on Irish unity tomorrow. So that's an important thing to remember. But I do not see a Gerry Adams Mark II emerging from within the political wings of the new IRA and other groupings. I do not see that same political traction, or I don't see a figure emerging who's, in a Machiavellian way, the way Adams did, engineering the movement out of the cul-de-sac of armed struggle into mainstream politics. And that's a problem. But one thing is, I agree with Suzanne, there is a minority of support, a core base that they have. This is the dissidents, the new IRA. And they can keep it going. They cannot win.
I think we actually will see a greater move into politics by dissident Republican groups in coming months. I just have a feeling that they maybe are looking there and they're thinking that there is a space for them and there is something that they can put forward. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some developments in the near future.
I think there is space for them. They need to exploit that space. And as I was saying, they need an issue to use to exploit it. It's true to say they don't have a huge amount of support, but then any insurgent, guerrilla, terrorist organisation doesn't need a lot of support. All you need is a basic level of support that enables you to carry out certain operations, certain attacks. But the dissidents do have, you know, the odd political representative in Derry, Gerry Donnelly. He was elected to Derry City Council. So that in itself is an indication that there are pockets of support, vital pockets of support, that enable the new IRA to carry on doing what it's doing, and it hopes to expand what it's doing as it expands, hopefully, in its eyes, its base.
There is growing discontent with Sinn Féin in working-class nationalist areas of Northern Ireland. That was seen in the recent Assembly elections, where Sinn Féin lost substantial support in its heartland of West Belfast and
in
Derry.
But it was not lost by the left, it went to the left.
But some of those voters would be dissident voters, but there is nothing to say that dissidents would get anything like the same level of support that the left-wing candidates did. But I'm just saying that there is a reservoir of dissatisfaction, people who are feeling that Sinn Féin politicians have done very well out of this, very well out of the piece, and they have left their communities behind. In many ways, Sinn Féin has become the new SDLP, which was the big middle class constitutional nationalist party that dominated Northern Ireland politics for so long.
The ironies of history, which we have to move on from, because we're now going to think about what it is that we do now. I suppose what people want to know is whether we're fated to suffer such groups coming and going forever, or whether they can actually be defeated. Suzanne, the question was raised earlier was whether, this question I thought Will Kerr rather wonderfully put, this muscle memory and the toxic narrative of touting, in other words, whether communities would actually, in the end, do what was necessary to give these people away. What do you think about that?
I think the PSNI probably is getting maybe more information from within the nationalist community than it's letting on. I would certainly be my belief that there are people in Sinn Féin who would be passing on information about dissident Republicans and what they were up to, because it's in Sinn Féin's interest to have all this stamped out. It wants to strangle these organisations at birth. And in terms of the general nationalist community, the dissidents have been very much to the front of standing with posters saying, don't pass information on to the PSNI. The PSNI would certainly obviously be hit figures within the Republican community. For the broader nationalist community, they would be more acceptable than the RUC. So the dissidents very much don't want a relationship to develop between the police and nationalist communities. They don't want to see the police in schools. They don't want to see them at community centres. They don't want to see any sort of rapport being built there.
So, Peter, presumably one of the biggest things that the police service in Northern Ireland and other people have to do is not do anything that would allow the new IRA to say, look, we told you so, there they go again.
I think one of the main lessons that the Brits, so-called Brits, have learned over the past 30, 40 years of the conflict is not to give the enemy an issue that they can exploit. And I think that, the days of knocking down doors in the middle of the night, smashing up people's houses, roughing up, young Republicans are gone, because the Brits have got the penny has dropped, that they have to conduct themselves, quotes, properly, and not give the IRA, the new IRA, the dissidents, any cause to increase their support.
So how will these people be defeated?
Well, I think it's going to be a combination of a number of things. I think that the problem is, in the age of austerity, you have a disaffected base of younger people who may be seduced into these organisations, and it's trying to address the economic and social problems that they face. But there's an ideological question too, which I don't think we can ignore, and it's this. For years and years, successive IRAs have been trying to deliver a message to Britain through violent acts, whether it's in the City of London, the bombs in Canary Wharf or whatever, get out of Ireland or we'll bomb you. They've always been delivering that message to the wrong address. They're forgetting about the Protestants and the Unionists in the northeast of Ireland, who are the real barrier to Irish unity. And unless that ideology of armed struggle is decommissioned intellectually, unless it's made clear to those Republicans that the only way you're going to get a united Ireland is to convince the Unionists in the north, and then I think we are fated for more trouble ahead, but it will be limited because we're in a different era now. We're living in a different technological era. And my little story at the start about being told to leave my mobile phones in the hotel before this bizarre encounter in a Donegal field, that's an example of how paranoid the dissidents are about electronic surveillance. And I think because we're not living in the era of the early days of the provisionals, this is different. And I think it's loaded against the dissidents in terms of ramping up their violence.
Well, that's me briefed, for which my thanks to Peter Taylor, Henry MacDonald and Suzanne Breen. I'll be back here in the briefing room on June the 30th. Please join me then.
Thanks for listening to The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. It was produced by Joe Kent, the researcher was Alex Burton, and the editor is Innes Bowen. If you enjoyed it, you might also be interested in File on 4, just one of the many other podcasts available from BBC Radio 4. Just search online.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.